Okay, who cares how it's spelled? It's still Tunage.
That was hilarious. Well, we started talking about Ellen, didn't we? As E-L-I-N would be a good name, perhaps for a kid.
Well,
you know?
That's why you must have messed me up or something. I just don't know. It's all your fault.
So you missed the E and then did the correction and just did one P instead of two.
Yes.
Oh, well, there you go. Good fun.
Yes, well, this is Conundrum with Cougar and Slider, and I'm Cougar.
And I'm Slider.
And Slider's got some worldwide weird stories that actually have to do with our topic. Some of them, don't they?
All of them this week.
All
of them. UFO themed.
Okay.
Yes, I've scraped the barrel, or perhaps not. They are good stories.
Oh, good. And why don't you let her rip?
Let her rip. Okay, then. And then I'll tell the stories. Righto. So, there are rumors coming out of Russia that Steven Spielberg is to make a documentary about Lake Baikal, the world's deepest freshwater lake, and which is a location of numerous UFO and alien sightings. The Siberian Times reported this week that the world-famous director will be visiting Lake Baikal in May to kick off the filming of Depth 211, or would that be 211? I don't know.
Well, that can't be the deepest part of the lake.
Well, 211 miles.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Kilometers, inches, I don't know what. Anyway,
right.
It's supposedly a documentary about one of Siberia's hottest hotbeds of UFO activity. Completely surrounded by mountains, the remote lake contains one-fifth of Earth's unfrozen surface fresh water. That's more than all the Great Lakes in the USA combined.
Wow.
It dates back 25 million years.
Wow, that's including Lake Superior, which is the largest freshwater lake in the world.
There you go.
Wow, I'm impressed.
It makes it the world's oldest lake by being 25 million years old as well.
Wow.
Of course, the Great Lakes were formed by glacier stuff, weren't they? So there you go. The stories from the location include large flying saucers seen by multiple witnesses in 1987 and 1990 and legends of lake monsters. It sounds like the perfect location for a Spielberg movie. Oh, at least documentary. If it's a documentary, it's got to be filled with all this stuff, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Because there's a thing about 9-foot-tall humanoids people saw.
Seriously?
Yeah, and then there's one about, I think it was a submarine went under. They turned all the lights off for some reason, but then there was a big glow all around.
Oh, my gosh.
So, that's very strange stuff. But also, cave paintings, I don't know if you've ever seen them. They look like some kind of Transformers or something. These guys with squared-off midsections that are large with a little head on the top.
Yeah.
You've seen
those
kind of things, spindly arms and whatever.
Yeah.
That's apparently what hangs out at this lake.
Wow.
So, yeah. Got to see what happens with that. It will be interesting. Alrighty, so next story. It was an ordinary night last night in El Paso, Texas, until three strange lights appeared in the desert sky. UFOs, perhaps. Multiple videos have surfaced on YouTube that show what appear to be three orange lights hovering in the air. The videos were filmed and uploaded by several people. Last week, ElPaso411.com, or is that 411?
Yeah.
Featured a mysterious craft that landed just north of El Paso city limits. And they say, could this be the aliens trying to make contact? So El Paso may be having a little flap. We don't know. We're nowhere near El Paso, of course, so we can't go and find out, really. Where is El Paso?
El Paso is towards the panhandle of Texas.
All right, they've all got
I believe it's south of the panhandle of Texas.
Okay.
So it's in western Texas.
All right. Well, interesting stuff going off there. But also interesting stuff going off in Nebraska, which is the next story.
Which is two states north of us.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. now, this one is thought to be a missile, a telegraph pole, or a UFO. Librarian Kerry Lee Shriver caught an interesting object on video in Alma, Nebraska last week. Kerry Lee, a school librarian in the town, posted the video to Facebook, and it's had over 620,000 views in just a few days. She's been updating people on Facebook, answering questions. Heading east from Alma to Republican City, she states that she was on the last curve, just trying to get some footage of the lightning storm in the area. She writes, I was guessing a meteor or Superman. Either way, it's something I'd never have thought twice about actually seeing if I hadn't gotten it on video. I shared it to the National Weather Service. She added, it's shared to MTV, and they're going to review it and talk about it.
And can I interject here that I did try to locate her? Well, I did locate her, but I did try to get her on the show.
Yes,
but
I got
no response back from her, but I thought it would have been interesting to hear her point of view on the story.
Well, and importantly, because perhaps it leapt out as a report to Julie and I, because of its similarities to a sighting that we had, on our yearly July the 4th rides out to watch fireworks and look out for anything out of place in the sky. And it is a strange thing, isn't it, that on July the 4th especially, you just expect to see fireworks. That's all you're going to see. You know, you've got your lanterns and things flying around.
Unless you're you and me.
That's right. One year we saw a helicopter low down with its searchlight pointing into the sky rather than toward the ground. And such slight changes
really
to what you expect
strange.
To see seem to be the signature, don't
they? And it was an orangish-red light pointing up.
That's it, rather than the white you might
yeah.
expect.
And then the one down by Lake Eufaula that had red and green lights.
That's what I'm going to say next.
Yeah,
yes.
Sorry.
Another time was near Lake Eufaula here in Oklahoma where we both have slightly different memories. We both saw something pass the car in a similar way to the thing shown in the Nebraska video. But whereas I saw a red light on the left and a green on the right, Julie saw a green on the right and a red on the left, as far as
I know. No, I saw a green on the top and a red on the bottom in a triangular formation, kind of.
Right. The thing was, they were the same intensity, completely the same intensity, color, brightness, as those seen on Love's Gas Station signs.
Yeah, do you know Love's Gas Stations? They're mostly around the south here, I believe.
Yeah.
But, yeah, if you know what we're talking about, it was that intensity.
Yeah, if people have seen those signs, I mean, they are everywhere, the Love's Gas signs. They've got a certain look to those lights, to the way the signs are lit up in the red and the green.
But we know it wasn't a Love's Gas
Station
sign.
No, we know where
near.
It's just... What kind of a thing is going on there? Is it masking your actual own memory or what?
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, so that video from Nebraska just stood out because of the distance away, the speed at which things were happening,
uh-huh.
and very, very interesting for our own experience a couple
yeah.
of years ago. Righty, anyway, to the next story. This is another video. It's from Kazakhstan, where a solid-looking ring is seen in the sky.
Oh, that's cool.
It is a great visual, isn't it?
Yeah.
The shape begins to unfurl and loosen towards the end of a couple of minutes' video and looks for all the world like a smoke ring. It's large, perhaps 100 foot in diameter, and is being slowly blown along toward the guy filming it by the wind as it slowly loosens in shape. The popular opinion seems to be that it's from an exploding electricity transformer. Several people having seen similar effects when that happens. It really does look odd, though, and is well worth looking at just to become familiar with such an odd thing in the sky. And I think it was an electrical transformer, maybe.
Yeah,
but why
probably,
did it produce...
but it was still cool looking.
It just looks great, yeah. And it certainly, you know, until you realize it's the transformer, it's unexplained. But indeed, was it? Or could it be an alien, you know, with a burst of smoking?
Remember the UFO at the Chicago airport, how it said it punched a hole into the... clouds.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if it's something like that.
Well,
I think it's a transformer, but still, it's pretty cool.
Uh-huh. Oh, maybe a transformer type of thing like in a Spielberg movie.
You know, you would think you and I would know about transformers exploding the way they go out around here and get hit by lightning.
Yeah.
We had a lightning strike so close, we had a transformer right across the street that it caused our car battery to go flat.
That was a weird effect.
Yeah. There was another one where Mark didn't have his arcade machines plugged in or anything, and it zapped out his monitors.
That's right. There was a monitor on the floor, which got completely busted. Another one had... all sorts and manner of colors all over it, you know, like when you might put a strong magnet next to a screen and it deforms the colors on it.
Yeah, so we get really close.
Zingers, we call them. They just kind of fizz,
yeah.
don't they?
Yeah.
They're that close. All right, so next story anyway. Are we alone in the universe? Top NASA scientists say the answer is almost certainly no. Ellen Stoffen, chief scientist for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, said at a public panel Tuesday in Washington that, I believe we're going to have strong indications of life beyond Earth in the next decade and definitive evidence in the next 10 to 20 years, adding, we know where to look, we know how to look, and in most cases, we have the technology, she said. So with such certainty, we might be forgiven for thinking that they already know something and are drip-feeding us the information piece by piece. And to the point that when life is found, we'll all just shrug our shoulders and whatever, it was expected. But don't forget the Brooking Report, either in this situation, where it was deemed that everyone would freak out if life elsewhere was found.
I think we're above and beyond that. Myself, you could come out and say there's...
But is that part of the conditioning?
I think we're already there.
You think so?
Yep. Yeah, we're already there. You could tell us that they've been landing on Earth for 50, 60, 100 years.
Uh-huh.
And I think we'd say...
Well, or since those cave paintings, if that lot's true.
Yeah.
up in Russia.
And just say whatever.
Yeah. The second to last story is about a Barwell woman who managed to capture video of a UFO after spotting a white ball of light hovering in the sky. Well, I guess she spotted the white ball of light and took it to be a UFO, but that's the way that the article reads. The woman, who was asked to only be known as Sammy, said she went to do some washing up when she spotted the unusual unidentified flying object from outside of her window. The 26-year-old mum, who lives in Stapleton Lane in the Leicestershire town, said, "I've seen drones and I've let off Chinese lanterns myself before." She added that she'd seen other UFOs on several occasions, but none like this one. The video could be of anything and is less than a minute long. Just a bright light that zoomed in on, goes all twonked out because of that, and then zoomed back from. But as yet, it's unexplained in the skies out there in Leicestershire, England.
Okay, we're being reconnected. Hello. Have we sound?
Are we back? Testing, 1, 2, 3. Should we just tap the microphone kind of thing? Anyone hear anything?
Test.
Mind you, there's a 20-second delay, but if anyone could just type in, got sound back, that would be cool.
Yeah, it went busy signal on us.
Yeah, beep. Well, it was busy. We were using it. Are we back? I guess, hang on, we're just trying to sort this out. Oh, sound is there.
Oh, good.
Right. Thank
you
very
Simon.
Much. Cheers, Simon. He's our sound engineer.
That is so weird.
Yeah, why?
All
why
I did, I pulled up the next story to read, and it went beep, 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 beep.
Mm-hmm.
We got busy signal. So.
Well, I was saying, you know, comical to think that
weird.
You might have said something contentious, but I don't think so.
God bless Blog Talk Radio. Oh, you're so wonderful.
Well, let's move on with the last one, and I'll say this quite quickly,
okay.
This last story. But it is the
all
biggest
right.
of the week, perhaps. Posted on the 3rd of April, and not the 1st. How would you like to be told that massive spacecraft have been seen on the dark side of the moon?
I believe it.
Dun, dun, dun.
I don't believe anything. What
well,
the
there
heck?
You go. A supposed government whistleblower recently stated that officials are baffled as to why numerous extraterrestrial craft have docked themselves on the opposite side of the moon. Dr. Eric Norton, an outside consultant for the NSA and NASA for the past 12 years, was hired to track various objects in space, including meteors, comets, etc., but recently has been following a number of unidentified objects heading towards Earth. The whole wrap-up of all of this, really, I'm just going to skim through there because we lost some time here, is that these objects were tracked about 200,000 miles past the planet Mars, heading our way, and then disappeared as they were coming up towards our planet. So, are the aliens already here, but invisible?
Oh, cool.
Did they change a different dimension? And, you know, that's what people see in the dream states and things. Who knows?
Who knows?
There you go. So anyway, that finally completes the Worldwide Weird News
stories
for this week.
Whether we get busy signals or not, we finished it. Let's give a shout-out to the room.
Sure.
We got Kathy's Distant Echoes, who is really me. I'm just using Kathy's name. We got Kathy B, who is really Kathy.
The real one.
Kathy's Distant Echoes, yes.
In the house.
Glad to have her here. We got Curious Times Chris. Yay! Gemini Moon. Yay! Simon Swain. Yay! With whom we would not be able
we
to run the show,
years
I
ago.
Think, I swear. We got Slatter 2732. That's
Kathy.
My Slatter. And Supernatural Radio, thank you for joining us. Yay! So, yay, everybody. Glad you're all in here. I'm going to start with the Virginia UFO. Virginia?
Oh, yes, Brazil.
Virginia, yeah. UFO incident, and I don't believe that is Portuguese for you know what. So, Virginia?
Virginia, I believe.
Virginia UFO incident is the name given to a series of events involving the alleged sightings and capture of by the military of an extraterrestrial being in Virginia, Brazil, in 1996.
1996? I thought it was earlier than that.
No. And I'm doing this later one because this is one that I don't think a lot of people in England, maybe not even Canada, have heard about. But it was a very important one at the time. Such reports were first broadcast in the Sunday TV show Fantastical of Rede Global and quickly gathered extensive media coverage worldwide, including an article in the Wall Street Journal, and has since become the most famous case in the modern Brazilian ufology, or ufology, if you want to say that. The Brazilian government has officially denied any claims of being involved with the captures of extraterrestrial biological entities, but some theorists claim otherwise, accusing the government of a cover-up. For some, the lack of reliable sources is evidence against its actuality. The testimony of unnamed anonymous officials, in quotes, individual, are frequently featured. UFO investigator Kevin D. Randall writes that this case is as complicated as any other in the UFO field. And Kevin Randall has a pretty good reputation as an investigator.
Yeah.
Randall notes that there's lack of physical evidence supporting the case and adds, in fact, we have been unable to verify much of anything. Mm-hmm. But what the overview of this of the case is that that had nothing to do with it. According to media reports, the creature was first sighted by three women ranging from 14 to 21 years old.
There's an interview of whom on YouTube that I know I've seen, those three ladies of Argentina.
They were also on UFO Hunters.
Ah, well, that might be the interview
that
I've
might
seen.
Be where you saw it. Yeah,
I knew it was Rang a Bell.
Yeah. Sisters Lillian and Valkyra Fatima Silva and their friend Katia Andrade Xavier. They allegedly saw the creature on the afternoon of January 20th, 1996, a biped about 5 feet tall with a large head and very thin body with V-shaped feet, brown skin, and large green red eyes. Excuse me, now you got me all boo. It seemed to be wobbly or unsteady, and the girls assumed it was injured or sick. Now, I remember from that UFO Hunters interview that they also said that it had two ridges going back from the top of its head.
Oh, okay.
And that's why they thought it was a devil.
Mind you, that's quite defining, too, two ridges bit is something, you know, added to a very vague account. You know, the two ridges would be highly specific.
Witnesses have noticed physical similarities between this alleged creature and the chupacabra, a cryptozoological creeper. Why do I say that? Creature reported in Puerto Rico and Central America. The Silva sisters said they fled, and they then told their mother what they had seen, that they had seen the devil. She didn't believe them at first, but when she went to the area where they had allegedly seen the creature and smelled a strong ammonia-like odor, her opinion changed. After relating their tale to family and friends, rumor began to spread throughout the city, such as UFOs were sighted, aliens were captured. 2 days later, another creature was allegedly found lying along the road. Three military trucks were sent to retrieve it.
All right.
So, in this case, it's the Army against word of mouth. Because the Army is saying here, the Army finds itself besieged on several fronts. A local mystic predicts that Vergina will suffer some kind of cataclysm in September as retribution for its blitzkrieg on interplanetary visitors.
Mm-hmm.
The Armed Forces news conference making Victory Day in World War II degenerated into a shouting match between a general and a television reporter pressing him about the extraterrestrials.
Really? A shouting match caught on TV?
Yep.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
An official briefing to debunk UFO conspiracies was overshadowed by an auto mechanic's claim to have seen yet another weird cylindrical aircraft, a cosmic encounter he reenacted with the aid of an aluminum coffee thermos.
All right.
And Stanton Freeman, a Canada-based UFO expert, says Vergina has the mixing of a cosmic Watergate.
Hmm.
So apparently there's a big cover-up going up there, whether, you know, it's word of who says, you know, my word against your word, I guess, kind of thing going on with the media and with the government and with the witnesses.
Really, interviewing first-hand witnesses is
yeah.
where you go, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rather than official statements and, you know, trusting experts, as it were.
Well, let's
I mean,
see.
Who's the best kind of expert on it is someone who's seen it, aren't they?
Right. Let's see if we can get another tag here without getting beeped off the line.
No, true.
Okay. This one is Aurora, Texas. If I don't know if people remember this one. This was back, well, do you remember when this happened?
In April, in shorts.
April 17th,
1897. That was in very small shorts then.
When, according to locals, a UFO crashed on a farm near Aurora, Texas. The incident, similar to the more famous Roswell UFO incident 50 years later, is claimed to have resulted in a fatality from the crash, and the alleged alien body has been buried in an unmarked grave at the local cemetery. Now, there's one thing about this time period in history, is that they used to make up newspaper stories just to get the entrance.
Oh, as filler and as some reason to buy the thing, yeah. A bit of the, what's it called, that paper over here? Globe News, News...
Oh, yeah.
Whatever, what's it called?
National Enquirer.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. And that's one of the hoax theories, is that this town was dying out because the crop, the cotton crop was dying of a boll weevil infestation.
Really?
Fire in the town's west side claimed several buildings and lives. Spotted fever epidemic hit the town.
Oh, gracious.
And nearly wiping out the remaining citizens and placing the town under quarantine. And finally, a planned railroad got within 27 miles of Aurora but never made it into town.
So really, I guess they were the opinion they could write whatever they want. No one's going to read it.
what they were trying to do is to get interest in this town.
Yes.
To get the train to come to the town so that, you know, it would repopulate the town and people would get interested in living there again.
Mm-hmm.
But according to what really happened, or what they say happened, was that during the 1896-1897 time frame, numerous sightings of cigar-shaped mystery airships were reported across the United States.
Indeed.
Now, were there Zeppelins back then?
Well, Led Zeppelins at 1P. Well, lead wouldn't fly anyway, would it?
A Zeppelin.
Uh-huh.
Were there Zeppelins?
Well,
there's
a French guy that was traveling around in a balloon in like 17 somewhere or other, wasn't he? I forget his name.
Around the world in 80 days type of dude?
Not quite, but he was certainly flying around Paris or somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah, so they go by, you know, air balloons go back a long way. Maybe even to those lines in Peru at Nazca.
Oh, yeah. Well, they were doing that thousands of years ago, if you ask me. One of these accounts appeared in the April 19th, 1897 edition of the Dallas Morning News. Written by Aurora resident S.E. Hayden, the alleged UFO is said to have hit a windmill on the property of a judge, J.S. Proctor, 2 days earlier at around 6 a.m. Central Time, resulting in his crash. The pilot, who is reported to be not of this world and a Martian, according to a reported Army officer from nearby Fort Worth, did not survive the crash and was buried with Christian Rice at a nearby Aurora cemetery. The cemetery contains a Texas Historical Commission marker mentioning the incident.
And the original gravestone itself was stolen, wasn't it, a few years back?
It was stolen. It was removed. So nobody would know where the grave was and rob it.
Yeah. Well, that's what they need to do, is exhume the thing to get
yeah.
it done with.
Yeah.
If it's still there. And if it's not there, there certainly would be evidence of a hole having been there, the ground having been mucked about with. Oh, is that your PC going a bit
strange, yeah.
The funny thing is, you unplug it to fix it.
Yeah.
Because it's the charger that does it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Reportedly, wreckage from the crash site was dumped into a nearby well located under a damaged windmill,
mm-hmm.
while some ended up in the alien grave. Adding to the mystery was the story of Mr. Bowley Oates, who purchased Judge Proctor's property around 1935. Oates cleaned out the debris from the well in order to use it as a water source, but later developed an extremely severe case of arthritis, and I've seen this.
Oh,
hand.
His hands
were
have got, yeah, golf ball things
awful.
On them.
Awful.
Very strange.
Which he claimed to be the result of the contaminated water from the wreckage dumped into the well. As a result, Oates sealed up the well with a concrete slab and placed an outbuilding on top of the slab. According to the writing on the slab, this was done in 1957. But then UFO hunters came and went into that well.
They didn't get very far, though, did they?
They didn't get very far.
They found a snake, did they? And that was about it.
Well,
which, if they found a snake, means that it isn't toxic, unless the snake died shortly after. But, I mean, it seemed to suggest that the water's all right down there.
I don't remember him finding a snake.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
oh,
that guy
okay.
with the beard went down.
Yeah. Yeah, it just said it was badly deteriorated and the radar could not conclusively prove what types of remains existed.
Mm-hmm.
So.
There's a fascinating case, though.
That's Aurora, Texas.
There's another point to this, isn't there? If it was purely a hoax by some guy, why would they have a gravestone actually there at the cemetery?
Right.
Why would the guy cap off that well thinking that it's got an infection in it from what happened? You know, all
and
of
from
this
what
stuff.
Happened to him.
And what happened to him, yeah.
Yeah.
It could have been an infection based on septic water thing, whatever. But it makes you wonder because there's a few details more than just some guy pulling a prank to the local paper by the seemings of it.
Yeah. But you never know.
Didn't they do a test on a tree for radiation or something?
Yes, they did.
Uh-huh.
And I think they found radiation. Because wasn't part of the tree cut off?
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to have been hit by, you know,
something.
The underbelly of it or something, yeah.
Right. Okay, the Lonnie Zamora incident. This happened in New Mexico. Was a UFO encounter of the third kind, which occurred on Friday, April 24th, 1964, at about 5:50 p.m. on the southern outskirts of Socorro, New Mexico. Several primary witnesses emerged to report stages and aspects of the event, which includes a craft's approach, din, conspicuous flame, and physical evidence left behind immediately afterward. It was, however, Lonnie Zamora, a New Mexico State Police officer who was on duty at the time, who came closest to the object and provided the most prolonged and comprehensive account. Some physical trace evidence left behind, burned vegetation and soil, ground landing impressions, and metal scrapings on a broken rock in one of the impressions was subsequently observed and analyzed by investigators for the military, law enforcement, and civilian UFO groups. The event and its body of evidence is sometimes deemed one of the best documented, yes, most perplexing UFO reports. It was immediately investigated by the U.S. Army, U.S. Air Force, and FBI, and received considerable coverage in the mass media. It was one of the cases that helped persuade astronomer J. Allen Hynek, one of the primary investigators for the Air Force, that some UFO reports represented an intriguing mystery. After extensive investigation, the AF's Project Blue Book was unable to come up with a conventional explanation and listed the case as an unknown.
Yeah, swamp gas doesn't create those features in those places.
Which is, it's really, you know, we know that to be called an unknown in Project Blue Book was
big deal.
Very rare.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't happen a whole lot because they did try to do the flock of geese and swamp gas and,
yeah.
You know, moon reflecting off Venus and the... Okay, the sighting. Alone in his patrol car, Sergeant Lonnie Zamora was chasing a speeding car due south of Socorro, New Mexico on April 24th, 1964 at about 5:45 p.m. when he heard a roar and saw a flame in the sky to the southwest some distance away, possibly a half a mile or a mile. thinking local dynamite shack might have exploded, Zamora broke off the chase and went to investigate. Though Zamora said he did not pay too much attention to the flame, that the sun was to the west and did not help vision, and he was wearing green sunglasses over prescription glasses.
Green?
Yeah. In interviews with... In interviews with Air Force investigators for Project Blue Book, he goes to some length to describe the long, narrow, funnel-shaped bluish-orange flame. He thought there might be some dust at the bottom. He attributed it to the windy day. The weather was clear, sunny sky, otherwise just a few clouds scattered over the area. He describes the noise as a roar, not a blast, not like a jet. Changed from high frequency to low frequency and then stopped. Roar lasted possibly 10 seconds as he approached on a gravel road. Saw flame as about as long as he heard the sound. Flame same color as best as I can recall. Sound distinctly from high to low until it disappeared. He explains that his car windows were down. Zamora notes no other possible witnesses except possibly the car in front, which he estimates may have heard the noise but not seen the flame because it would be behind the brow of the hill from their viewpoint.
Yeah, so as the terrain lies, it's not a simple case of a car being in front. He's sort of like round a corner and down a hill.
Right. And it says here, Zamora struggled to get his car up the steep hill, so apparently he's off-road at this time. Successful on the third attempt, he noted no further noise. For the next 10 to 15 seconds, he proceeded west, looking for the shack whose precise location he did not recall. It was then he noticed a shiny object to the south about 150 to 200 yards that at first he took to be an overturned white car up on the radio or on trunk, with two people standing close to it. One of them seemed to notice him with some surprise and gave a start. The shiny object was like aluminum. It was whitish against a mesa background, but not chrome, and shaped like the letter O. Having stopped for a couple of seconds, Zamora approached in his car, meaning to help. Zamora only caught a brief sight of the two people in white coveralls beside the, quote, car. He recalls nothing special about them. I don't recall anything particular shape or possibly any hats or headgear. These persons' name normal appeared normal in shape, but possibly they were small adults or large kids. So he did actually see, and it goes on about...
Well, isn't that strange how he thinks he's looking at a car, but it's not quite right because it's upside down.
Well, he calls his sergeant to come out and see what he finds, and they find burning brush in the area as well as indentations where the landing gear were.
But obviously no upturned car.
Right. Well, he watched the thing take off.
Which is a pretty good trick for a car.
Yeah.
An upside down one.
Yeah. I just didn't want to get into all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, he watched the flame light up underneath the object again.
It's a pretty powerful welding torch if they're trying to fix it.
Slowly start to take off, and then it zipped off really fast.
I never knew all that.
And then they found all this evidence afterwards.
Uh-huh.
On the ground.
Because all I think I remember is, bug was on the aerial or something, the aerial being bent of his car.
Oh, that was a different one. That was one that I don't have this is on our case, but I will tell you about it. Let me see, is it the next one?
Oh, I thought that was the one where they kept the car as well.
No, that's in Warren, Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
That's in my home state, and that was in 1967, I want to believe. And a police officer was out about 1 o'clock at night when a shining object came flying at his windshield. And he flipped off, he didn't flip the car, but he went driving off the side of the road because this thing scared him so bad. And the evidence that it was left was... a dented chrome dash, or what do you call that, between the lights, grill.
Oh, okay, yeah.
A bent aerial and skid marks on the roof.
Skid marks on the roof?
On the roof of the car.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And, yes, they have kept this car. It's
yeah, and it,
still,
it was a police car, though, wasn't it?
Yep.
Same as Zamora was a policeman.
Yeah.
That's why I've mistaken it.
Yeah.
Oh, so we've got 15 stories
and
today.
That's, yep, and that's still up in Warren, Minnesota.
Still actually existing to this
yep.
day.
In fact,
to be
UFO at. Hunters went and looked at it,
uh-huh.
and they couldn't find any reason for the...
But as physical evidence, a car is pretty good stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not just a pebble, is it, or something?
No. Say, can we do a favor?
Uh-huh.
Can we take a break about now?
We sure can.
I'm getting coughs and junks like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, sure.
So let's do I don't know, maybe Canadians, maybe Chris knows this one. I didn't know it until I went to college, and it's from about 1980. And it's called The Beat Goes On, Switching to Glide by the Kings. And it's 5 minutes and 46 seconds long.
Please greet the Kings.
Hey!
You know, one of these days we ought to let Mark put his music on here. And we'll
oh,
see.
Yeah, love it.
How that would go.
Some proper drum and bass and a bit of decent synth stuff, 909s, 303s, good acid going on. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We're there. No, actually, that had an excellent bouncy chorus to it. I quite like that.
You like that song?
Yeah, it's all
okay.
Right. It doesn't offend me. Not
all
much.
Right.
Gemini Moon remembered it too, we noticed.
I saw that.
Yeah.
I'm going to give another call out to the people who managed to hang in here. We've got Kathy Sisson Echoes, who is me. Kathy B, who is really Kathy Sisson Echoes. Curious Times, who is Chris. Gemini Moon, who is not. Rihanna, Simon Slane, and Slider.
Alrighty, where are we going now in the world for some strange UFO stuff?
We're going to Kecksburg, Pennsylvania.
Ah, Trouserburg.
Trouserburg?
Yeah, well, you know, in Cheshire, Kecks are trousers.
You call them Kecks?
Okay.
A
pair of Kecks.
Okay. The Kecksburg UFO incident occurred on December 9th, 1965. I was shortly born before then.
Well, very shortly when you're a baby, aren't you? Not
yeah, I was a couple months old.
Uh-huh.
At Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, USA. A large, brilliant fireball was seen by thousands in at least six U.S. states, including Ontario, Canada. It streaked over Detroit, Michigan, Windsor, Ontario area, reportedly dropped hot metal debris over Michigan and northern Ohio, starting some grass fires, and caused sonic booms in the Pittsburgh metropolitan area. It was generally assumed and reported by the press to be a meteor after authorities discounted other proposed explanations such as plane crash, errant missile test, or re-entering satellite debris.
But just to say, when you see the reports and people are in the town and saying what went past in the sky, you would think that was an asteroid meteorite type thing, wouldn't you?
Until it makes the right angle turn.
Uh-huh.
Which is, it doesn't mention that in this article, but that is something I have seen in documentaries about this. It was generally assumed to be reported. Oh, it was generally assumed and reported by the press to be a meteor after authorities decided. I read that already. Okay. However, eyewitnesses in a small village of Kecksburg, about 30 miles southeast of Pittsburgh, claimed that something crashed in the woods. A boy said he saw the object land. His mother saw a wisp of blue smoke arising from the woods and alerted authorities. Another reported feeling vibration and a thump about the time the object reportedly landed. Others from Kecksburg, including local volunteer fire department members, reported finding an object in the shape of an acorn and about as large as a Volkswagen Beetle. Writing resembling Egyptian hieroglyphics was also said to be in a band around the base of the object. Witnesses further reported that intense military presence, most notably the United States Army, secured the area, ordered civilians out, and then removed the object on a flatbed truck. The military claimed they searched the woods and around and found absolutely nothing. Well, this is really strange. I found absolutely nothing, and they pull out this object on a flatbed truck covered with a flap that's about the size of what, you know, the few witnesses were able to
see. About the size of a Volkswagen car.
Yeah. So that's about the Kecksburg.
Yeah, and I think that was Die Glocke. I think that the Germans there in World War II got the thing fired up. It disappeared and reappeared in Kecksburg.
I was going to ask you about your theory on that.
Yeah, well, why not? It certainly was a something, and if it did do a 90-degree turn and what have you,
yeah,
you know, maybe it shifted dimensions and then there you go. Pa-ching.
And showed up, what would that be, 40 years later, 20 years later.
Yeah. It was a great escape idea, you know. Put people into these little pod things and have them return 20, 30 years later. I guess if they returned 200 or 300 years later, no one would know who they were anyway.
Yeah.
So you've done your escape. At the end of World War II.
Well, our next story here is the Kelly Hopkinsville encounter, also known as the Hopkinsville Goblins case, and to a lesser extent, The Kelly Green Men case was a series of incidents, alleged close encounters with supposed extraterrestrial beings. These were reported in 1955, the most famous and well-publicized of which centered on a rural farmhouse at the time belonging to the Sutton family, which was located between the hamlet of Kelly and the small city of Hopkinsville, both in Christian County, Kentucky, United States. Members of the two families of at the farmhouse reported seeing unidentifiable creatures. Other witnesses attested to lights in the sky and odd sounds. The events are regarded by ufologists as one of the most significant and well-documented cases in the history of UFO incidents and are favored for the study of ufology. Ufologists have claimed it was investigated by the United States Air Force, although no evidence of an investigation has been found. So what happened here was these families were playing cards in the house.
Just I've got the makings of a short horror film type story.
Yeah. And one of the boys went outside and saw these goblins type creatures in the trees and stuff, and they started having a shootout with them. And they managed to get away from the farmhouse, went to the state police officer's barracks. And when they returned, they found evidence of the shootout and the damage done, claw-like scratches on the doors
The
windows, and yeah.
Wow. Hey, I'd just like to note here that Linz has made it.
Yay, Linz. Thanks for coming by. So, that's basically the
Hopkinsville. Yeah, I'm sure I've seen something where, like a reenactment where they had one on the roof and all sorts of things going on.
Mm-hmm.
Marvelous case.
All right, where do we go next? We go to the Cayome Chihuahua.
Mexico.
This one's a real interesting one. If I can find it. Oh.
Hope so.
I do too. I have it here. There we go. All right. This is interesting because it's a cross the borders kind of recovery thing that has really been questioned by people as to whether the United States was right to go in and do this or not.
So it happened in Mexico.
Well,
States guys went in. Okay.
It flew over the Gulf of Mexico, entered Mexico about 40 miles south of Brownsville, Texas, which is at that very point of Texas down along the Gulf of Mexico.
Oh, right. So in other words, it's pretty much into Mexico anyway.
Right.
Oh.
All right. On August 25th, 1974, at 22:07 hours, U.S. Air Defense radar detected an unknown object approaching U.S. airspace from the Gulf of Mexico. Originally, the object was tracked at 2,200 knots on the bearing of 325 degrees at an altitude of 75,000 feet. Of course, a course that would intercept the U.S. territory at about 40 miles southwest of Corpus Christi, Texas.
Hang on a minute. There's only a U-2 could go that height, isn't there? Indeed, if that. 75,000 is a heck of a
height. That's a heck of a height, yeah. After approximately 60 seconds of observation, the position at a position 155 miles southeast of Corpus Christi, the object decelerated to approximately 1,700 knots and turned a heading of 290 degrees and began a slow descent. It entered Mexican airspace approximately 40 miles south of Brownsville, Texas. Radar tracked it approximately 500 miles to a point near the town of Cayome in the state of Chihuahua, not far from the U.S. border. There, the object suddenly disappeared from the radar screens. During the flight over Mexican airspace, the object leveled off at 45,000 feet, then descended to 20,000 feet. The descent was in level steps, not a smooth curve or a straight line, and each level was maintained for approximately 5 minutes.
Oh,
The object was tracked by two different military radar installations. It would have been within range of Brownsville civilian radar, but it is assumed that no civilian radar detected the object due to lack of any such reports. The point of disappearance from radar screens was over the barren and sparsely populated area of northern Mexico. It was first assumed that the object had descended below the radar's horizon and a watch was kept for any reemergence of the object. None
like
occurred.
Like pills in the way kind of thing.
Yep. It was first assumed that the object might be a meteor because of the high speed and descending flight path, but meteors normally travel at higher speeds and descend in a smooth arc, not in steps. And meteors do not normally make a 35-degree change in course. Shortly after detection, an air defense alert was called. However, before any form of interception could be scrambled, the object turned to a course that would not immediately take it over U.S. territory. The alert was called off within 20 minutes after the object's disappearance from the radar screen. 52 minutes after the disappearance, civilian radio traffic indicated that a civilian aircraft had gone down in that area, but it was clear that the missing aircraft had departed El Paso International with the destination of Mexico City and could not, therefore, have been
in that place anyway. Uh-huh.
Yep. It was noted, however, they both disappeared in the same area and at the same time. With daylight the next day, Mexican authorities began to search for the missing plane. At approximately 10:35 hours, there came a radio report that wreckage from a missing plane had been spotted from the air. Almost immediately came a report of a second plane on the ground a few miles from the first. A few minutes later, an additional report stated the second plane was circular-shaped and apparently in one piece, although damaged.
The second plane was circular-shaped.
Yeah.
Your sign.
Yeah. A few minutes after that, the Mexican military clamped their radio silence and all such efforts, on all search efforts. Radio interceptions are reported through channels to the CIA. Possibly as many as two additional government agencies also received reports, but such had not been confirmed as of this date. The CIA immediately began forming its recovering team. The speed with which the team and its equipment was assembled suggests that this was either a well-rehearsed exercise or one that had been performed prior to the event. Well, what goes on to say is that by 2100 hours, the recovery team had been assembled at Fort Bliss, and they went into Mexico to recover this UFO, but what they found was all the Mexican recovery team dead.
Found.
And so what they did, and the plane wreckage, of course, that guy was dead. What they did was they hauled it all into a mound and blew it up and recovered the UFO. It was already on a flatbed.
It wasn't nice to blow up for stuff.
No, it was already on a flatbed with straps and stuff, but apparently they all died of radiation poisoning or something.
Within about a couple of hours.
Yeah.
Oh.
So, but the American soldiers went in hazmat suits. So they recovered the UFO, and what happened to it, nobody knows.
Well, yeah, people would say it's in one of them doors, under, you know, the Bob Lazar door things at S4, wouldn't they? One of those that sat there. Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah.
Good story, though.
How much do I need to say about Betty and Barney Hill?
Oh, that'll do.
Okay.
No, not really. No, they were the first proper possible abduction.
Abductees, if you don't count, what's his name? With the Zeta Reticuli.
Billy Meyer?
Yeah, wasn't he in the 1950s?
I'm not sure if he was later.
Oh, okay.
But the star map of the hills is very exciting. Very cool, that is.
Benny and Barney Hill were Betty and Barney Hill, not Benny and Barney.
Benny and Barty.
Benny and Barty Hill. Benny and Betty, now you got me say it. Barney and Betty Hill were an American couple who were allegedly abducted by extraterrestrials in a rural portion of New Hampshire on September 19th, 1961 through September 20th, 1961. They were apparently coming home from a short vacation in Canada, and they were coming through New Hampshire, I want to say, or Vermont. Yeah, no, New Hampshire. And they saw this star acting erratically, so they stopped the car for a closer look, and as well to walk their dog, Delcy. They got a dog named Delcy. And they stopped at a scenic picnic park just south of Twin Mountain, and worried about the presence of bears, Barney retrieved a pistol that he kept in the trunk of his car. Betty, through binoculars, observed an odd-shaped flashing multicolored lights travel across the face of the moon. Because her sister had confided in her about having a flying saucer sighting several years earlier, Betty thought
that might be what she was looking at, observing,
which was to her detriment because later on, therapists, psychologists are saying, "Oh, she was just
trying to stay up with the
hysterical. She was just hysterical and was having" these images and thought that they were hallucinations. This one ticks me off. Psychiatrists reported later suggested that the supposed abduction was a hallucination brought on by the stress of being an interracial couple in the early 1960s United States.
I think they've gone through all that before they got to being a couple, really.
Well, not only that. Okay, there may have been stresses of being an interracial couple, but to manifest that in hallucinations about UFOs is just a stretch that I cannot believe. And they were saying that Betty had in her mind she just had a lifelong UFO fanatic. But documented evidence indicates that Betty and Barney had never read a book on UFOs prior to their UFO encounter in September 19th, 1961.
Might just take it and put it in the pile of evidence, really, can't you?
Yeah.
You know, decent, good stories.
Yeah. And, of course, we know that she has evidence of her dress being torn. There's a pink dust on her dress, and Barney's shoes were scuffed up.
Bill Clinton never met her, did he?
Oh, please.
Uh-huh.
Oh, please. Not milk. Sorry, that's a
so where are we off
joke. Next, Malmstrom Air Force Base.
Oh, is this the one where the UFOs apparently switched off nuclear weapons?
Yeah, well, this one and Minot Air Force Base, and we'll be doing both of them.
All right.
Let me get Malmstrom up here. All right, this is one I'd really like to read through because it's pretty interesting. Missile maintenance crews and security teams were camped out at two of the launch pit facilities, otherwise known as LFs, having performed some work during the previous day and stayed there overnight. During the early morning hours, more than one report came from the security patrols and maintenance crews that they had seen UFOs. A UFO was reported directly above one of the E-Flight LF or silos. It turned out that at least one security policeman was so affected by this encounter that he never again returned to missile security duty. Around 8:30 a.m., Fiegel, the deputy crew commander, DMCCC, is deputy missile crew commander, is what it's called, and briefing Carlson, the crew commander, MCCC, on the flight status when the alarm horn sounded. One of the Minuteman missiles they supervised had gone off alert, become inoperable. It was one of the two sites where maintenance crews had camped out on site. Upset, thinking that the maintenance personnel had failed to notify him as required by procedure when the maintenance work is done on a missile, that the missile was going off alert status, Fiegel immediately called the missile site. When Fiegel spoke to the on-site security guard, he reported that he had not yet performed any maintenance that morning. He also stated that a UFO had been hovering over the site.
Wow.
Fiegel recalls thinking that the guard must have been drinking something. However, no other missiles started going off alert in rapid succession. Within seconds, the entire flight of 10 ICBMs was down. All of their missiles reported a no-go condition. One by one across the board, each missile had become inoperable. When the checklist procedure had been complete for each missile site, it was discovered that each of the missiles had gone off alert status due to a guidance and control system fault. Power had not been lost to the sites. The missiles simply were not operational because, for some unexplainable reason, each of their guidance and control systems had malfunctioned. Two security alert teams, or SATs, strike teams, were dispatched from Echo to these sites where the maintenance crews were present. Fiegel had not informed the strike teams that one of the on-site guards had reported a UFO. On arrival at the LF, the SATs reported back to the UFOs had been hovering over each of the two sites by all the maintenance and security personnel present at each site.
So they actually told him what had gone on, that they had seen these things in the sky.
Yep. Captain Don Crawford's crew relieved the Echo flight crew later that morning. Crawford recalls that both Carlson and Fiegel were still visibly shaken by what had occurred. Crawford also recalled that the maintenance crews worked on the missiles the entire day and late into the night during his shift to bring them all back on alert. Not only had all missiles been lost to our deterrent forces, but had remained out of service for an entire day. Because of this unique incident, as an ex-missileer describes it, all hell broke loose. Among many calls to and from the E-Flight LCC was one to the MCCC of Oscar Flight, which links to the equally dramatic story of what happened at another LCC the same morning.
That's the Minot one.
This is Malmstrom still.
Oh, I see. Oh,
this
my.
Is Oscar Flight now, what happened at Oscar Flight. Oscar Flight LCC was located a mile or two south of the town of Roy, about 20 miles southeast of the Echo Flight LCC. So they're about 20 miles apart, what these two.
But they're part of the same facility.
Right. The following is told by Robert Salas, who was the DMCCC on O Flight that morning. My recollection is that I was on duty as Deputy Missile Combat Crew Commander below ground in the LCC during the mornings of 16th March 1967. Outside above the subterranean LCC capsule, it was typical clear, cold Montana night sky. There were a few inches of snow on the ground. Where we were, there were no city lights to detract from the spectacular array of stars, and it's not uncommon to see shooting stars. Montana isn't called big sky country for no reason, and the airmen on duty topside probably spent some of their time outside looking up at the stars. It was one of these airmen who first saw what first appeared to be a star beginning to zigzag across the sky. Then he saw another light do the same thing, and this time it was larger and closer. He asked this flight security controller, it's called FSC, a non-commissioned officer in charge of Launch Control Center site security, to come and take a look. They both stood there watching lights streak directly above them, stop, change directions at high speed, and return overhead. The CO ran inside the building and phoned me at my station in the underground capsule. He reported to me that they had been seeing lights making strange maneuvers over the facility and they weren't aircraft. I replied, "Great. You just keep watching them and let me know if they get any closer." I did not take this report seriously, and I directed him to report back if anything more significant happened. At the time, I believed this first call to be a joke. Still, that sort of behavior was definitely out of character for Air Security policemen whose communications with us were usually very professional. A few minutes later, the security NCO called again. This time he was clearly frightened and shouting his words. Sir, there's one hovering outside the front gate. One what? A UFO. It's just sitting there. We're all looking at it. What do you want us to do? What? What does it look like? I can't really describe it. It's glowing red. What are we supposed to do? Make sure the site is secure and I'll phone the command post. Sir, I have to go now. One of the guys just got injured. Before I could ask about the injury, he was off the line. I immediately went over to my commander, Lieutenant Friend Wiewold, who was on a scheduled sleep period. I woke him and began to brief him about the phone calls and what was going on topside. In the middle of this conversation, we both heard the first alarm klaxon resound throughout the confined space of the capsule.
That was really, really... really
freak you out, wouldn't it?
In a nuclear place, you've got alarm klaxons going off,
yeah.
UFOs in the sky. You know they can do something because the missiles went offline.
Well, this is what happened here. It says, and both immediately looked over a panel of annunciator lights at the commander's station. A no-go light and two red security lights were lit, indicating problems at one of our missile sites. Fred jumped up to query the system to determine the cause of the problem. Before he could do so, another alarm went off at another site, and another simultaneously. Within the next few seconds, we had lost 6 to 8 missiles to a no-go inoperable condition.
Yeah, but at this point, you're going to be ringing Russia, aren't you, saying, look, we've got trouble here, and it's not our doing.
Yeah, right. After reporting this incident to command post, I phoned my security guard. He said that the man who approached the UFO had not been injured seriously, but was being evacuated by helicopter to the base. Once topside, I spoke directly to the security guard about the UFOs. He added that the UFO had a red glow and appeared to be saucer-shaped. He repeated that it had been immediately outside the front gate, hovering silently. We sent a security patrol to check the our LFs after shutdown, and they reported sighting another UFO during that patrol. They also lost radio contact with our site immediately after reporting the UFO. When we were relieved by our scheduled replacement crew later that morning, the missiles had still not been brought online by on-site maintenance teams.
Mind you, it's not like you can fire the things at the UFOs, is it?
No, and that's funny you say that because at the Minot Air Force Base, the commander told them to shoot it, and he said, sir, I don't think that would do any good.
Yeah, all them.
Yeah.
Send a Minuteman after it, right above us. Oh, is it fire?
Minot Air Force Base was a Project Blue Book case dated October 24th, 1968, when missile crews, control personnel and maintenance personnel observed a UFO in the vicinity of the base. And basically what was happening was there was a B-52 jet bomber, a JAG-31, flying at 20,000 feet, was on a calibration check and request clearance from radar personnel. And what happened was the radar personnel said, while you're out there, could you take a look around and take a look around at 11 o'clock and see what you see? And they said, well, we see a glow, and then check again. And they said, there's pretty thick haze up here. We can't see it. But then they started having radio troubles.
Of course, you knock nuclear missiles out, they're going to probably affect the plane too.
Well, this one didn't have nuclear missiles go out. They just saw it with the B-52. And this is Minot, North Dakota, where I used to live. Not in Minot, but the battle.
Next to Fargo, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, no, that was straight across the state.
No, I mean, but you used to live near
Fargo. I used to live in Fargo, yeah. Let's see here. Some tags, and we want to go to the Battle of Los Angeles.
Yeah, which was a one-way battle.
Which was a one-way battle, because there was more than, what, 4,200 shells shot at this supposed UFO.
Mm.
And this was shortly after Pearl Harbor, so...
They're going to shoot at anything, aren't they?
They were afraid of a Japanese attack on the coast of the United States. And, well, let me just read here. The Battle of Los Angeles, also known as the Great Los Angeles Air Raid, is a name given by contemporary sources to the rumored enemy attack and subsequent anti-aircraft artillery barrage, which took place from late 24 February to early 25 February 1942 over Los Angeles, California. The incident occurred less than 3 months after the United States entered World War II as a result of the Japanese Imperial Navy's attack on Pearl Harbor, and 1 day after the bombardment of Elwood on... Of Elwood? I don't know about that. On 23rd February. It says, initially the target of the aerial barrage was thought to be an attacking force from Japan, but speaking at a press conference shortly after, Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox called the incident a false alarm. Newspapers of the time published a number of reports and speculations of cover-up. Some modern-day ufologists have suggested the targets were extraterrestrial spacecraft. When documenting the incident in 1983, the U.S. Office of Air Force History attributed the event to a case of war nerves likely triggered by a lost weather balloon.
Oh, come on.
Well, if you're going to shoot at this thing with 44,000 rounds and stuff and it's a weather balloon, don't you think it's going to come down?
Unless they're really, really bad shots.
Well, people were killed, which is the sad thing. There were
rounds. Falling back or something.
Just being misshot and ricocheting and stuff, yeah.
Oh, no.
There was a couple of people killed.
Oh.
But there's a lot to go through here, so this is one that you might want to look up on our site, and which I will. Once again, yes, 10 minutes left, sweetheart. Simon's telling us.
Oh, yes.
So I put our WordPress up there again.
All right. Conundrum with Cougar.wordpress.com.
Let me see here. Kenneth Arnold.
Oh, yes, yes. Mr.
He pretty much started the whole new, what do we call the new history, the recent history of ufology.
Yes, when he saw a bunch of Houghton 9s flying in the sky.
Can you tell us about your theory about that?
Well, no, I mean, if you just look at the shapes that he drew, and then if you research the Houghton brothers in World War II, and especially the Houghton 9, which was one of the world's first jet fighters, first jet flying wing anyway, then the similarities are very, very similar, and the Americans did find the plant where the Houghton aircraft were being made. So there were a couple of them out there, as it were. The production ones were being made in the factory. We know they brought a version 3 across. Did they build a few or finish off some of the ones that were in the hangar because of their kind of space-age design of these flying wings?
That would fly like skipping discs.
Which they would.
Yeah.
And they could have been on test in a formation, and that's what he saw.
Yeah.
It'd be
Horton.
A real-world reason for seeing such a thing.
So to look this up, it's H-O-R-T-O-N.
No, H-O-R-T-E-N.
E-N.
And then 1X, you can put
1X.
Akhenix, yeah, for Roman 9. And also it was known as the 229. That was its designation when it got built at the Gotha Wagon Fabrik in Germany.
Just to give you some ideas of what Mark is talking about, because what Kenneth Arnold is describing is what he saw looks an awful lot like these Houghton 9
jet fighters. Which were ready to go into service, really, but then, well, they were getting ready to come into service. But then the war ended, so luckily they never did, because they would have been really good with radar. and they were fast. But that's my theory on that guy. But anyway, so please do continue.
I think we will just totally skip Roswell, New Mexico, because everybody knows about Roswell, and get to the Barron Mountains in Wales.
Oh, yes.
Does that work for you?
That's a little known one, is Barron.
And you're going to have to help me with this.
Because I'm kind of Welsh.
Because you're kind of Welsh and you kind of know how to pronounce it. Yeah, like
it's
that.
It's one place in Wales.
Yeah. How many letters in that name?
Too many.
Do you know off the top of your head?
I don't know.
More than in the alphabet, I bet. On 23rd January 1974, in the Barron Mountains in...
How do you spell it?
L-L-A-N-D-R-I-L...
L-A-N is like Flan.
Clandrillo, Merionethshire. Merionethshire, North Wales, lights and noises were observed that were alleged to be related to a UFO sighting in Kader Barron and Kader Bronwyn. Did I say those right?
Yeah.
Scientific evidence indicate that the event was generated by an earthquake combined with sightings of a bright meteor widely observed over Wales and northern England at the time. On the evening of January 23, 1974, residents of the Barron Mountains area in North Wales reported a loud noise and bright light in the sky. When ufologists claimed that a UFO crashed and the British government covered up the military's recovery of a crashed spaceship, some tabloids newspapers jokingly labeled it the Roswell incident.
Roswell.
Yeah. Scientific evidence indicates the event was generated by an earthquake combined with the sightings of a bright meteor repeated that sentence.
Padding in the game, you know.
Yeah. But an earthquake combined with sightings of a bright meteor.
Yeah, how does that work?
That,
how many bright meteors do we see with all the fracking earthquakes around here?
Yeah, tell me about it. The classified Ministry of Defense document suggests the incident was caused by the combined effects of an earthquake and a mid-air.
Uh-huh.
The Institute of Geological Sciences, now British Geological Survey, reported that a magnitude 3.5 earthquake was felt at 8:38 p.m. that night over a wide area of North Wales and as far as Liverpool, also in Formby, 13 miles north of Liverpool. It was not immediately identified for what it was, hence the police investigation. However, the magnitude of the shock was such that it had been due to impact. The resulting crater would have been large enough to be easily visible. The unusual lights reported may have been simply a meteor, but may have also included a phenomenon known as earthquake light. Yes.
Yeah, well, they had rescue workers seen walking about in the fields, didn't they, when they... What was she? Was she a midwife? Was one of the first on the scene and was watching people walking around looking for this craft that apparently crashed. There's a lot more to that story, the Barron Mountains one. It's well worth a look at.
I'm going to shoot, let me see, right to Delphus, Kansas, if I can find it here. Here we go. And leave out Rendlesham because everybody knows Rendlesham, I think. We've got 5 minutes. How about if we just close the show down?
Do a quick one. You got a quick one?
I don't have a quick one, really.
Oh, okay. Then. What was the summary then of this one in Kansas?
The one in Kansas was a boy was out checking the sheep and he saw an 8-foot round UFO hover over some land by some trees, and they found some, I want to say hydroponic, I'm not sure if that's the right word for material that will not accept water.
Oh, well, I know what you mean, though.
Yeah, and the mother touched this stuff, and her fingers got all numb, like there was a local anesthetic.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, wiped it on the pants of her legs. or the legs of her pants, and went through and got her legs all numb and stuff.
So like an acid.
Didn't go away for a long time.
Is that the one with the circle, like a mushroom, whatever they call those circles? Where?
Yeah, like a fairy ring.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. And it left that impression, didn't it, for many years, and nothing would grow. If I remember the story now. So we're closing on that one, are we?
Yep,
you,
I think so.
What are you singing on the way out, then?
What do you feel like?
Ah, a bit of drum and bass.
But
what have we got instead?
Okay. Sherry Darling by Bruce Springsteen. That's it from him. Peace and blessings to you again.
We'll be right back.